I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thank you all so much for coming out. I'm not surprised you're all here because it's the hot ticket, honestly. And well done for getting tickets. We are honestly really excited to have you all here to help us celebrate Amy Key's Arrangements in Blue. I tried to plan things as far ahead as possible, but I think almost as soon as I heard that this was coming out, I wrote to Mia and was like, can we have to do an event? Please. And we've managed to do it. Thank you so much. Thank you also to Megan Nolan for being here, who's going to be in conversation with Amy. Absolutely thrilled and can't wait to hear what you've got to say. Our guests are going to talk for about 45 minutes as usual. There'll be time for questions afterwards. That's it from me. Please just help me welcome our guests. Thank you both so much for being here. Cheers.
Thank you. Thanks everyone for being here. I'm really happy and honoured to help Amy celebrate her amazing book, which I think everyone knew would be amazing, but exceeded all my expectations anyway, and it's very beautiful and I loved it very much. So I'm really happy to be here with you all to celebrate it and with Amy. So I think we will kick off with a short reading from the book, and then if you could give me a shout when it's near 45 minutes so I know when to wrap up. But so we'll hear from Amy first, and then I'll ask some very difficult questions.
Thank you so much, Megan. And thank you so much for coming to my first Arrangements in Blue event. I'm just going to read from the introduction. So going to start at the beginning. It makes sense. And then hopefully that can set up the conversation that Megan and I will have. Love. Looking for something. What can it be? When I travelled alone to Los Angeles in early 2020, a taxi driver asked me why I'd come. I told him I was there to write about the singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell. It felt good to have a story. Joni Mitchell, he said. I'm just thinking if I know someone who knows Joni. I didn't say anything. Wait, I think I do. I've known the musician Gillian Welsh for like 20 years, he said. I'll give her a call. Maybe Gillian can hook you up, get you 5 minutes on the phone with her or something. Here, take my number. I took his number, even though I knew I would not call him. I was attracted to the idea of being someone who would call him. And while I did, hope to write about Joni, she wasn't why I was there. I'd had the trip planned long before the idea came along. I was there to write and think, but I didn't expect much of myself. My friend and poetry mentor, Roddy, had died the month before. I arrived with a grief that I hoped might melt into California's huge horizons. I hoped newness might knock grief clean out of me. Joni Mitchell's album Blue has been part of my interior world for 30 years. My copy of it, on vinyl, has grown warped from being kept in direct sunlight, scratched from my careless ways with record sleeves and liners. When I play the record, it sounds as though it's being received from space, the music delivered through a fuzzy channel of feedback. It's been so well used as to take on the quality of being commonplace, where dings and scratches and fading are accepted because of its sense of belonging to me. But I don't need to play the album to listen to it. I can sing it from start to finish, with all the emotional and tonal shifts, and often do. I can summon every element of the music in my head. My paternal grandma, Eva, used to say to me, "Amy, I hear music." I loved this mysterious declaration. I now know what she meant. Using thought as my instrument, I regularly play Blue from start to finish without a pause. I think back to 1992, the first time I heard Blue. My best friend had recently begun to have periods, and one had just started. She was sleeping over on the pull-out bed that lived under my own. We called it the surfboard. My red and purple lava lamp was on. The rest of the lights were off. We listened to the album on cassette, borrowed from my older sister, Rebecca, an emotional inheritance. Hi, Rebecca. The first song is All I Want. Into the dark cocoon of our sleepover, Joni sang, "I am on a lonely road and I am travelling, 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 looking for something. What can it be?" I remember having a strange feeling, an anxiety-adjacent excitement, a bodily sense that I too would experience something transformative, and soon. I joined Joni on the road she was travelling. I knew I would not sleep until the cassette had clicked onto the B-side and I heard the last note of the last song. In my memory of that night, the lava lamp was like the pain my friend was experiencing, the hot red pulse of it, pain as a red energy, as hypnotic, pain that moves as an octopus might in the deep seas of womanhood and romantic grief, thresholds I had yet to cross. I was 14 and yearning to swim in both. That night, Blue ignited my desire and ambition for romantic love, my idea of how I would press my heart against the world. What appealed, I think, was the way it described the world. Oh, the way it described the complexities of love. It was the first representation of love that seemed truthful. Love is best and worst. Joy and sorrow. I'd hurt someone, they'd hurt me. Love meant staying and going, the bothness of it suddenly clear. And love did not mean convention, perhaps not marriage, perhaps not children. The music's harmonic cascades in all their sprawling highs and lows mapped the course I, a romantic love, would take. Blue seemed to give me a complete palette to paint myself into, all life's possibilities. I took in the album's emotional range and it became innate. I accepted Blue as part of the language I had to express myself. In early crushes and relationships, I test my feelings against Blue's sentiments, as though the album provided an ultimate scale of intensity that would reveal whether the love had substance. Was this a love so strong I couldn't numb it out of myself with wine? Did it have the endurance of the Northern Star? Could it keep away my blues? Would it anchor me where I stood or let me sail away? Looking back now, I think I tricked myself into believing almost all my romantic attachments measured up against Blue's scale. I accepted love would bring me pain, so much so that joyful love became not an expectation, but an occasional gift. Love meant being prepared to bleed. I was ready to commit to it. But while I have certainly bled for romantic love, I've largely found myself living without it. The last time I had a boyfriend, I was 22. I'm about to turn 44. In my early years of knowing Blue, I thought I was at the beginning of romantic love's presence in my life. All beginnings incorporate the potential for an end. I just had no idea how rapidly I'd get there.
Thank you so much. So I wanted to ask first about...
I'm going to
But yeah, we're very, very into yeah. it right now. wanted to ask about the journey from the Granta essay to the book. Mm. So I'm sure most people here know that the book began as a Granta essay that was, you know, incredibly warmly received and people really meant a lot to so many people. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the journey and also whether when you were writing the essay, if it already felt like it needed more space or whether the reception to it led to the feeling that you should expand. Mm.
So the Granta essay was a really interesting experience for me because I had initially set out to write about Joni Mitchell's relationship to some contemporary poets. And that's what I pitched to Granta. And it was only when I started writing that I sort of found my way into this, you know, like a little fissure that I was needing to crack open. And it was through working with Eleanor Chandler, the editor at Granta, that I think we realised this sounds very cheesy, but like the soul of the essay was in, like the thing that anchored the essay was this idea of romantic love and the way I had been listening to Blue for so long had, I don't know how kind of my expectations of love had been upended. And as I was writing that essay, I did get a feeling like I could probably keep going for a long time. But like we had to stop and, you know, the essay was only supposed to be a certain number of words and it needed to be published. But I probably wouldn't have revisited it, at least not necessarily in prose. I might have revisited it in poetry had it not reached such a wide readership. And then people began to ask me, have you thought of extending this into a book? And the answer to that was no, but now I am, yeah. and I say that with some trepidation because obviously like the worst thing, you know, the fear that keeps me awake at night is like someone going, oh, it should have just stayed an essay. You didn't need a whole book for this. but I feel like there was definitely more to explore and actually I feel like people living single lives or like experiencing the absence of romantic love has become more of a talking point more recently, and that tells me, you know, there's a real appetite for exploring this more.
Mm-hmm. And as a quick aside, how did the reception to the essay feel at the time?
How did it feel? I mean, it felt pretty, like it was a mixture of exhilarating and really gratifying because I was writing about something that caused me real pain and to feel like, you know, the majority of the responses I got made me feel like I was understood and I was legitimate in feeling the pain that I felt. And allowing for that space of kind of ambivalent, you know, complex feelings about romantic love, it not needing to kind of eschew it all together or like wholly embrace it and be in this sort of middle territory where actually it would be really, I desire it, but I also need to feel intact and have integrity as a person mm-hmm. with if it doesn't end up being part of my life in the way it is for other people. Mm-hmm. But it was also like, it was quite tiring somehow because when people are responding to stuff and they're sharing their responses with you, it's quite emotionally, what's the word? I don't know.
Draining?
Yeah, like maybe not, because like draining feels like a little bit
too negative, or
yeah, but like it's almost like you can withstand it for some amount of time and then have to retreat. I think, yeah.
And yeah, that kind of leads a little bit into what I wanted to talk about in terms of the word bravery. Mm. So I've noticed that Amy's book has been described as brave quite a lot in the reviews and the way people speak about it. It's also a word that people applied to my book when I published it, and it was a kind of a complex word for me and brought up a lot of emotions. And I was wondering, how do you feel about that word? Is it validating or patronizing or both? Do you feel you've done something brave? What's your relationship to this word in terms of the book?
Yeah, it's such a, I think it's a really good question. I when people tell you you've done something brave or they think you're brave, like there is a part of me that thinks, ah, do you think I've done something foolish? Mm-hmm. Is what you're saying to me, I wouldn't reveal that much of myself. I think you've been a bit careless or you're being dangerous and I wouldn't advocate for that, but like good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you with your like bravery. And so I do have a kind of a strange relationship with the word. I think when people apply it to the book, like I want to read it in good faith that maybe they're recognizing that it can take courage to talk about things that are uncomfortable or that cause us shame. Mm-hmm. And there were definitely moments when I was writing where I felt like I'm having to be really brave. Mm. And actually, in a way, that was the only thing that mattered. If it was like overcoming my reluctance to speak truly about an issue and not try and flatten it by like making it a generalization and to talk specifically to my relationship with different things.
Yeah.
So that felt like the right thing to do. And it definitely took courage, but I wouldn't necessarily get more from someone telling me it was brave than I got from myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I while you were speaking there, I just thought of this tweet that I saw yesterday that was like me putting up the most flattering picture of myself that ever existed. Sure. Everyone being like, you're so brave for varying beauty standards. Which is sort of how I felt when anyone was like, you're so brave. I was like, oh, really? I'm just doing my own thing. Like, I'm just trying to portray myself. So if that's brave, then it's kind of...
It can make you feel really ashamed if people are like, oh, that's, you know, like, you're wearing an outfit, and they're like, oh, a very, you know, brave choice. You're like, you're really insulting me.
I wanted to ask also about there's a part where you say something about asking whether there's something wrong with you as regularly as you, you know, consider very daily mundane issues, and this is like a constant in your mind's repetition or whatever. Do you feel like that constant questioning, is there something wrong with me, is to do with singleness, or is there a particular variant of that question that everyone experiences but is particular to singleness for you?
Yeah, I think it's probably the latter, because I feel like everyone who like wants something and can't get it or is denied it, like it might be, I don't know, your card's been declined, or you don't get a job you want, or you can't have children, or you know, whatever it is, you can end up interpreting that as a personal failure, like there is something wrong with me, and if I could just fix that thing, it would come to me. I don't understand, you know, like mm-hmm. I can't comprehend why this isn't happening. But I feel like when you're single and you're asking yourself what is wrong with me, it's very, very hard to like rationalize out of it when it continues for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because people's like platitudes don't change. You know, people will still say to you like, one day you'll meet your person, or like they might be just around the corner, or if you stop looking. So you're held in this space of like eternal failure until that thing happens. No one will like let you just be and then be like, oh great, bonus that, you know, they've got a romantic relationship, but it was all great beforehand. And I think there's a particular shame perhaps for single women or like femme presenting people, because all of the way we've been socialized is to be valued for our sexual romantic desirability. And if you don't feel like you're attaining those standards or you're not being chosen, then you've somehow fundamentally got it all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it is specific to singleness, but I think there's probably just like a particular category of it that manifests in a slightly more pernicious way, mm-hmm. perhaps.
And then, relatedly, you write about like other sorts of women, as I also have done in my work quite often. And as in, okay, so you say of a man who reveals that he has a girlfriend after you sleep together, I was hotly desired, but not for long. Elsewhere, a more refined, less eager woman waited.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, when you think of these other sorts of women, is the crucial difference one of appetite, which you kind of come back to there, where it's about eagerness or like a restraint? Do you feel, when you, like, in a very general sense, perceive this other category of women, is the difference to do with appetite, or is there, like, are there lots of different things at play?
I think there are lots. Appetite is definitely one of them. And I guess also because I've got a fat body, there's all of this shame connected to that, which makes me feel like not like the archetypal desirable human. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely connected. But I do wonder whether there's my bewilderment at not finding romantic love, or, you know, like not locating good romantic relationships, has had something to do with that my confusion being like literally worn on my face when it's not happening, and that I guess I've told myself that must be very, very off-putting for people, because I don't know how to, for example, play it cool. Like, what is this playing it cool? Like, what is this restraint? I'm just quite a giddy person, and when I like people, you know, I just tend to sort of really bound out with that. Like, I don't think people are ever confused about whether I like their company or not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No. It's I was just reading. I was reading a couple of days ago one of these many Ozempic articles, but not to do with the weight loss stuff, but I was interested to see that apparently it also affects your, like, impulse control in general.
Oh, God.
And I did think, God, that would be nice if I didn't, because it apparently affects, like, online shopping impulses and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, like, imagine if you could just take that and then you had no impulsivity.
Just turn off those impulses.
Not that I would, like, I think I valued that stuff about myself, like the, what you're talking about, basically, like the lack of boundaries and... you know, like the inability to pretend that you're cool, I think is I like in people personally, but yeah, it's an interesting one when you see someone without that and you're like, oh, but they are so valued in the world because they're able to restrain themselves.
Yeah, and restraint is like, it just feels like such a moral quality. Like I'm almost like obstinately rejecting it because I kind of feel like there's this puritanism, attached to it that I just want to disregard.
Mm-hmm.
Which possibly makes me sound more rebellious than I actually am.
And we were talking a little bit ago about, there's a quote by this comedian called Margaret Cho, where she did this interview with The Guardian, where she was talking about her life after divorce and after being seriously ill and a suicide attempt. And she was talking about her life now and trying to live alone and happily living alone. And she says, you know, as a woman, we're told, oh, you're going to die alone. Like, that's the biggest fear. But I'm actually really hopeful that I die alone. And, you know, talks about that being a positive thing for her in her life, and came up in my life not long ago after a separation with somebody. I was discussing it with a friend, and I said, almost as a reflex, like a post-breakup reflex, I don't want to die alone. And he responded, from what you're telling me about your behavior, it sounds like you sort of do want to die alone. And I thought, well, maybe, yeah. Like, I don't think or feel that, but in my actions, it does seem to be the case that that's not a bad outcome for me. Like, I don't find that to be the most alienating outcome I can imagine, certainly. And then I was thinking about how extremely focused the whole conversation on singleness is about dying alone.
Really?
Like, that's, it's always coming back to dying alone rather than having a life alone. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, why do you think everyone is so focused on this dying alone idea instead of, like, all of the other things there are to talk about? Do you have any thoughts about this as a focus?
I think we're just, I mean, I am very frightened of dying.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm frightened of dying alone, though. I'm more frightened of, like, the practicalities of dying without people who consider it their responsibility to look after me. Like I really, I'm like, oh, so every now and then I'm like, oh, if it just save us some money, I can get 24-hour carers and I will like convert my house and it's all going to be cool and I can just hang out with my friends. But like, you know, care in older age can be really, really brutal and very, very stressful for family members. So, you know, on some level, I'm like, that would just be the ideal situation. I just get looked after, I maintain my dignity and independence, and then I get to be around people I love. But I think the thing I was mentioning to Megan, I was at a funeral the other day of someone who died very young. They died when they were 57, which to me, you know, I'm in my 40s, so like that's the next decade. And we sat in this funeral service and it was kind of beautiful and moving and upsetting in the way that funeral services are. And my colleague turned to me and said, that's what you'd want, wouldn't you, for you? And I was thinking, no, because it was, you know, there was always talk about like, he's died young, but it was a life well lived because he had a wife and two children and he had made an intact life that that is what's considered a life well lived. And he was a beautiful man who I loved, and his life was great, but I know that if I'd said, well, if I die alone, everyone would be like, well, that's really, really tragic. And I was thinking about the epigraph from Megan's novel, the Raymond Carver poem, Late Fragment, which is like, you know, what do you want most? And it's like to find myself beloved on earth, or I can't remember the exact line, I butchered Raymond Carver, I'm sorry. But there is this kind of fairy tale that you're told that if you just find that one true love, life will have meaning and you can just pop your clogs without a regret in the world because you'll have done everything right. And I don't think, I hope I'm not on my deathbed going, oh, I wish I'd had a few more romantic relationships.
This is a difficult thing to talk about, but some of the more devastating parts of the book are about your friend and mentor Roddy Lumsden, who's, you know, your relationship with him and his death and what happens after his death. And he was single, but you actually describe in quite a lot of detail, which I found really fascinating and moving, the support network which surrounded him when he was dying. And I was wondering if that experience or your relationship to that death had moved anything for you in that way, or if it impacted your thoughts about singleness or aloneness and that sort of thing in that way.
Yeah, that's I have to think about what I think about that. I think the thing with Roddy is he was acutely unwell for several years, and I think what we saw was like this curve of engagement with him and his illness. So there was a point at which he was absolutely embraced by a community of people. And then towards the very end of his life, and I talk about how I kind of, you know, abandoned him. I didn't see him for several months before he died because I got to a point where I was like, I can't confront it. He didn't have that at the very end. I mean, everybody was there at his funeral and was sad. I don't criticise anyone. I criticise myself, but for different reasons. And I think what I saw was you almost have to have like this relay, of squads who can support someone through a community, because everyone, what happened was there'd be people who could offer a lot and then something would happen in their life and the priority would shift and they would have to withdraw. And then he would have like quite inconsistent kind of caregiving and like the community wouldn't like be around him in the same kind of way. And I think that's probably because we are kind of conditioned to prioritize like the family, the biological family unit. So like their first order, and then friends come in this second category of people. And I guess we just maybe might look at that a little bit. You know, I don't know what I'm saying, you know, for, because I'm not sure what I'm going to follow it up with. But, but he had family members who could care for him, but it, like, each brother couldn't do it alone. Yeah. There needed to be other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we expect families to do the heavy lifting of a lot of traumatic stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, it's not always going to be possible for them. Or maybe it's better if it's not them. I don't know.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I'm going, sort of thinking about it at the moment a lot because of a lot of, I don't know, friends are, you know, marrying off and moving and all those sorts of things at the moment in my life. And, those sorts of fractured social groups that you are part of that are very core and, you know, important to you in every way, but you can't maybe count on them once they start family. It seems like a very difficult thing to negotiate right now. Yeah.
Yeah. I went through a real, like, I got relegated in order of priority for, like, in a whole friendship group because all my peers got married and had children.
Yeah.
I was the only single person. And if I hadn't have encountered a lovely group of friends who were all younger than me, I'm not sure what my life would be.
Yeah. I feel the same. I'm just gonna be cruising. Yeah. Cruising the readings for 25-year-olds until I'm dead. Yeah. Hands up, know basically nothing about Joni Mitchell. I've probably only heard Joni Mitchell when I'm in your house, basically. would the book have come about if not for the Joni Mitchell element? Mm. Do you think you would have had the same drive to write about these things without that as the framing?
Yeah, I think this is a really good question. So I've definitely been writing about these things for a long time in poems. Much more indirectly. So I've always been motivated to write about them. But I feel like my relationship to romantic love and the shame I felt at not having it and the kind of like hurt feelings that I had and kind of questioning about my own motivation, like, do I want to go out and get it? I don't think I could have contained that. It was too much of a mess without using a form. And I guess what I did have done in the book is use a form like Joni rein me in and help me think things through in a kind of more not systematic but just like a more controlled way, like gave me areas of focus. And I hope what that does is like stop me just like, you know, for 200 pages going like, whoa, it's me. You're like, oh, it's awful being a single person. No, because like, that's not how I feel.
Is that one of those?
Yeah, that's one of those. So the book definitely owes a lot to the kind of structure that Joni helped to provide it. And I, to be honest, I could have picked like a whole different set of Joni songs to explore the same thing from different albums. Does that answer?
It does.
Sorry.
And do you listen to the album with any difference now after writing about it?
Ah, my editor Jacob asked me this the other night. Like, can you still listen? I can just still listen to it completely normally,
right,
which I'm really glad about. I really hope I don't ruin it for anyone else. If I either read the book and they're like, no, it's that Amy Key book. She's ruined Joni for me. But I feel like that's the genius of that album. Like, I cannot believe that I've been listening to it solidly for over 30 years now. Mm. And I'm not like skipping tracks or...
Is there anyone contemporary you feel anything similar towards?
Who do I love? I really love Wise Blood and Jenny Lewis. So like they're not kind of like Joni Mitchell kind of tier, but I feel like they've accompanied me for several years now, and I can imagine taking them into the future.
Yeah. When we're dying alone, we can listen
when
to
we're
those,
dying
yeah.
alone with our expensive care package.
So on that note, right, in terms of contemporary artists, were there any And actually, when I was thinking of this question for you, I realised I had no idea if I know of any models of...
Like... She meant me musicians. Sorry, I just think...
Oh, no, I meant like...
Oh!
Just now I meant any contemporary musicians. But in general,
yeah.
are there any women who are artists or writers or thinkers or whatever kind of creators of things that were models for you or that you had in your mind while you were writing the book who have written or... referred to singleness or to solitude that you had in mind when you were writing, inspirations or whatever.
Yeah, definitely. I had when I was working on the book proposal, I had several epigraphs, like for each chapter. Like every page was like this heavy ornamentation of epigraphs, and eventually, my agent was like, "You need to say goodbye to them now. Like, we will now say goodbye to the epigraphs." But they were writers like, well, Elena Ferrante, like her book Days of Abandonment, was something that I was really thinking about in the way it so viscerally like describes female desire and despair. Like she's got this amazing line about like how we personify the desire of the cock and we call it love, which like I just found so stressful to read, but like wrote that down. Who else? Like a Denise Riley poem, well, like an extract from a Denise Riley poem where she says, some people fall in love, some people don't, oof, oof. Mary Gateskill, her book Lost Cat, where she talks about how many times she like opened the door, like pleading for someone to love her, only to get the door shut in her face. What else? Yes, just like many.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And memoir as a form, would you do it again?
I'll have to see how this goes,
Is that true, right? In the tree, you want to see like how...
I need to see how it feels. Like the experience... I'd love to write more memoir, more like personal narrative essays. But like I don't have like a kind of... personal book in my back pocket that I'm like, no, my memoir can come out on, I don't know, like being a civil servant or something. I personally really love personal narrative. And the person I should have mentioned is Vivian Gornick, who wrote The Odd Woman in the City, which is like this account of like living a solo life. But it's not a life without romantic love or desire. And I think this is the thing that's really important to kind of recognise. You can be talking about both things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what about you?
Memoir?
Yeah.
I don't know. I sort of also feel like I don't have any narrative in my life at the moment. Or yeah, there's no like story in my life at the moment, and it'll only become clear a long time in the future. Don't really know how to describe myself anymore. As in, you know, like when before I had a public-facing writing career, I was able to narrativize myself much more easily. And now I suppose I have like another bit of my brain is alert to the fact that other people will read it if I publish it, and that changes things.
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully they will. eventually, yes, I think. But I don't know when. It feels nicer to not for the moment, I think.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll... Your next thing will be poetry again, or do you know?
Don't know. I haven't been writing any poetry. I don't know whether it was Roddy dying that sort of just made me go like, need a break from poetry, or whether I just, I really needed the direct address, I guess, of like, I think this, I think that.
Yeah. And did you, this is a question a lot of people asked me after my book came out, like, did you think about other women while you were writing this book? So like what I mean by that is was it intentional in any way to want to offer solace to other people who've experienced similar things to you, or did it exist as a solely subjective project that hope, you know, that, you know, from a very abstracted sense maybe it will impact other women's experience of this same issue, or was that in your mind when you were writing, basically?
I feel like when I was writing, it was more, I've just got to like shut out the idea of an audience or a reader, or particularly like an address to somebody like me. Mm. But now that it's published, I do hope that people who have encountered like difficulty in finding romantic relationships will find comfort in like an account of it that doesn't say to them, you can just be a strong, independent person and you don't need a relationship. You can just be your best self on your own. Or say like, here is, I was alone and then I found love. And I feel like those two kind of narratives feel like very easy to access.
Yeah.
And there is definitely less that's in this in-between state of you can powerfully want something, find that it's not accessible to you, and still find ways to create a meaningful life for yourself that has joy and pleasure and plenty of love in it. And I think that doesn't need to be just for people who have romantic absence in their life. Like there are things we all want and desire that we don't get, and we have to find a way of living alongside that, and not kind of undoing everything that's good by considering ourselves like temporary in this temporary state of wanting that will get fulfilled. So there's definitely, people in my mind now who the book is kind of for, if that makes sense, but they weren't who I was writing to I was writing it.
I really enjoyed the part where you're speaking to a younger woman who's relating to you. I mean, I find that to be a very spicy and great bit of the book.
Because
I feel like that is something that probably, I can imagine it would be difficult to admit that you feel any sort of animosity towards another woman saying these things to you.
Yeah.
But actually, while I was reading your book, I posted a picture of it on Instagram, and somebody I know who's like a 25-year-old very hot girl who has a boyfriend every couple of months is like, this is me. And I was like, no. you've been single for 2 weeks, it's okay, so I can imagine it must be a strange, it might be strange in the coming weeks and months and years for you to have to hear from people who you do not relate to you and don't accept that they relate to you.
there have been quite a few messages that are like, I really seem, this is what I need. I've been single for a couple of months. And I'm like, well, just you wait. No, that's mean. I'm not mean.
No, I actually thought it was a brilliant bit of the book. It really felt so true to I mean, it is frustrating for people who don't experience the same things. You need to say that they do, basically, even if they mean them very well. So I thought that was a very nice thing to read, actually.
So actually, someone was asking me the other day, like, what's the book about? And I tried to explain, but they were colleagues, so I sort of didn't want to like get into like a big conversation about it. And actually, the first thing that they did was start saying about how terrible it is to be married and have children. And I was like we don't have to set this up as a kind of head to head like rap battle or something. It's like, it's fine. You can be married and have children. It's great.
And then I guess I also just wanted to ask about, I came to know you as a poet first, obviously, as I guess a lot of people maybe have done. And I was wondering if your interest in this book, how much do you consider them to have been explored already in your poetry, or how new is the material for you here?
Good question. So I guess the honest answer would be it's probably been explored a lot in my poetry reading, because I've sought out poems that I've felt have helped me understand or like articulate something. And I quote some of them in the book. So for example, the way Rosemary Tonks writes about love and desire and her kind of absolute fury with herself for having any kind of emotional relationship to romance. So as a reader, like I feel like that has informed like the content of the book. And my poetry book before this, Isn't Forever, definitely was me going into this territory of feeling incredibly lonely, I guess, and exploring loneliness. And it, weirdly, I don't actually feel like a very lonely person now, but I did at that point. And I think that's when I was really considering motherhood as well. So some of that stuff, I reread the book before writing this just to remind myself like what state of mind I was in at particular points that I record in the book. But like my first poetry book was just like almost like a kind of horny like create, you know, starry-eyed love book where I was just fancying lots of people.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I think it's time to take questions. If anybody has any questions for Amy about her work or the book or anything at all.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a massive Joni Mitchell fan, and I was wondering, this is probably a really, really hard question, but if you're going to go to a desert island and it's the end of the world, and you have to bring 3 Joni Mitchell songs.
Oh my God.
Could you do it? Could you pick 3?
Could I pick 3? Shall I just go really fast? I'd probably pick Willie from Ladies of the Canyon because I love that song. Coyote probably from Herisher, and the last time I saw Richard, maybe. Why was I that? No, that was so stressful. Great question. Never ask me that again, please.
Hello. I can't remember if you talk about this in the book, but I keep reading a statistic that is middle-aged single women being the most happy people, and it's kind of, I just thought if you did mention that, I don't remember, but also it's kind of like the pressure on like women to kind of present at every family occasion, and you know, that kind of idea. And also I was just thinking about all the idea of alternative families and the importance of that within a lot of cultures, and kind of whether I just the idea of you know, talking about dying alone, I'm like, I'll come and
thank
if
you
I'm
so
still much. Alive, I'll come and do, you know, mop your brow. Or I think there is, I don't know that I don't know if that was a question. Sorry.
Thank you. I've got to declare I know Sophie. So I'm really good. Sophie just offered to come and mop my brow when I'm dying, which I'm really grateful for, and will hold you to. So your question was kind of about the single woman in the kind of wider family unit, and like I've got to be sorry because 2 of my siblings are here, so like don't take this personally, but there is something about like if everyone else is in a partnership or they are they have children, you're kind of there as like what's the word, like a bit of a mule, like you're kind of ferrying drinks around, preparing dinner, washing up, making sure that everything is coordinated in the right way, and you probably be given a rubbish bed, except because I think my family, I've really thrown tantrums about this. You know, think times have changed, so I'm, you know, very, very grateful for that, thank you. I would love the I would love this, you know, idea of an alternative kind of family, and to consider, like, as a kind of cishet woman, what can I learn from the queer family? Probably a great deal. But even in my social circle, which features lots of queer people, the majority of them are in relationships, and they're still, you know, that's the top tier, right? So there's no one for whom, like, I get to be top tier all the time. Like, my friends are amazing, but, you know, I'm just aware of the reality of the situation. So that's one of the things that makes you want to form a romantic attachment. So just so you can go, like, oh, thank God, you know, like, you have to just deal with me, and I can just give myself over to it. Sorry. Yeah.
Hi.
Sorry.
Hello.
This is not really a fully formed question yet, because I'm running out of comparisons in my mind. But I wanted to ask, with kind of the resurgence of this kind of conversation and kind of being single and living life and creating a life, and I guess the resurgence of bell hooks and stuff like that, and people writing about radical intimacy, do you want your book/writing to exist within that kind of, I guess, space and canon? Or how do you think people are going to engage with your book kind of existing in this space?
So I read Bell Hooks Is All About Love as I was writing the book. Like, if I'd read that book at school, it really would have changed my life and would have probably altered my entire relationship to love. So, like, I really wish it was on the curriculum. I would love to be read alongside books like that, but I don't know whether I will be. It, like, I guess readers will tell me at some point where it fits, because, like, it's not a researched book. It's not drawing on data about single people or like an investigation into how other people encounter singleness. It really is just an account of my life, and that will be really interesting for some people, but for other people, they'll want more of that researched kind of lived experience alongside research. I hope that the two things can be rich to have together. Yeah, thanks for the question.
Hi. The first thing I wanted to say, what you said about dying alone really made me think about, like, a conversation I had with my friend once, where I was talking about, like, a failed romantic interest and wanting to prove to them that, like, I could be, like, wife material, and that feeling like a failure. And then she was like, but you're not. I was like, wow. But yeah, the other thing I wanted to say was, like, do you feel like, when you were talking about that concept of, like, being the only kind of single woman and being around a straight family where, like, everyone's getting married and having children, I was wondering, like, for example, like, being a writer or, like, having something else, I feel like in those environments is sometimes seen as, like, you've chosen, like, something else.
Yeah.
And the same with, like, if you were, like, a banker or something. And do you think that that gives it in, like, for maybe, like, people that are married or people that are having children, do you think that, like, they have a bit of a value system attached to, like, whether they think that you've made a choice to do something else rather than have children, rather than, like, if you just didn't have children for no reason? Or, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, what do I think about that? I think for some people, they will kind of, it's not that they'll think you've got that, so you've made this conscious choice not to have what I've got because you've chosen this other thing. But what they might think is, I realise this is very big for you, in the same way that it is very big for me to have a committed partner or a child or, I don't know, like, a particular job. But I think they're sort of weird things to compare, aren't they? Like, I did have a friend say to me once when I was, like, talking about finding it difficult to encounter news of another friend being pregnant, oh, but you've got your book. And I was like, well, you know, like, a book is a thing in its own right. Like, we don't have to have, like, surrogate child books and stuff. Because, like, that's just weird to me. I I feel like we probably need to have a lot more honest conversations between women who aren't having children, either out of choice or because it hasn't happened for them, and like a much less defensive conversation between them and women who are having children, because what I see is like people taking stands that like that everyone's just getting very, very offended by the pure act of somebody not having a family or finding stuff about motherhood boring or I don't know what I'm saying now. Sorry, I'm gonna stop. Best to stop.
Just one small question. Did you ever call the cab driver?
No, I didn't call the cab driver because I'm a chicken, but also he was kind of weird. Yeah. He was really, he was into doing extreme assault courses. He did Uber, he did like Uber for fun. Like, that is that an LA thing? Maybe.
Hi, thank you for this book. I mean, I haven't read it yet, but I feel, I mean, I'm in my 30s, but it's so relatable. Yeah. My question is kind of two-part. did you ever consider writing this memoir on any other artists other than Joni Mitchell, or was it always going to be her? And how did you find it fitting with the kind of overarching themes, if any?
So I didn't, but like I'm a big nerd for the music. Yeah, should I go now? Sorry. Yeah. Like I probably could have like picked The Hounds of Love or something and done the same thing, but it wouldn't have. It didn't occur to me. And I'm glad it was Joni, because Joni feels absolutely right. The thing that I did was I sat down and I listened to all of the songs and all of the lyrics, and I picked one thing from every song that helped me explore something that I thought was denied me because I don't have a romantic partner. And it kind of aligned so beautifully. Like, I'm not saying my book aligned beautifully. I just mean like the
you can say that.
Yeah, the content of the songs aligned so beautifully to the things I wanted to explore. It felt very easy. As soon as I decided on the form, I was like, yeah, it was intact. Does that answer your question?
Yes. And lastly, yeah. Have you read Conversations on Love or the other one by Olivia Petter? I forgot the book.
So I have not read Conversations on Love or the other one.
It's really, really good.
But I have listened. There is a podcast, isn't there? A Conversations on Love podcast. Am I not imagining? Yeah. Yeah. So I have listened to some of those conversations. Yeah. They're really great. And I really love This Is Love, the American podcast as well, which explores different kind of types and aspects of love.
Yeah. Also, as a massive Joni Mitchell fan, I'm very excited about. I just wondered if you'd had to get any permissions or you'd had any dealings with the Joni Mitchell estate.
Yes, many, many dealings, and had to get permissions, and I'm not willing to tell anyone how much permissions there are. All my only advice is never, never, ever quote lyrics in a book. That's, yeah. Yes, yes.
Thank you, everyone. It is a brave book. It's vulnerable and it's really, really thoughtful. It's amazing. Oh, it's really thoughtful. So thank you all for bringing such thoughtful questions, and thank you both for bringing such like an open and fluid conversation. Amy's going to sign.
Megan is signing.
If you haven't got the book already, buy it. If you have, buy another one, give it to someone else. Most importantly, stick around, get some book signed, have a glass of wine, and thank our guests. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.